Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. Today's Monday, April 22nd. I'm Stephen Overly. My guest on today's show has the distinction of being named the first AI minister in the world. That was back in 2017. His Excellency Omar al-Olama has a longer title these days. He's the Minister of State for Artificial Intelligence, Digital Economy, and Remote Work Applications in the United Arab Emirates. That makes him central to the UAE's ambitions of becoming a world leader in AI. It's already home to Falcon, one of the world's biggest open-source AI models, and it's developed another, called JICE, that is trained in both English and Arabic. And last week, one of its AI companies, called G42, got a major investment from Microsoft, part of a U.S. effort to pull the Gulf nation closer to its tech orbit and away from the influence of China. I interviewed al-Olama on Friday at a virtual event hosted by the Atlanta Council. Here's a shortened version of our conversation. Your Excellency, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Microsoft announced it will invest $1.5 billion in G42, a leading company in the UAE. I'm curious what assurances have been made to your government and to the U.S. government that that partnership will be developing AI in a way that's considered secure and responsible.
So there are a few things there. The first is compliance is a big thing for the U.S. And I don't think that a company the size of Microsoft with, let's say, the backing of the U.S. government is going to go into business and actually invest in a company if there weren't reassurances that they see eye to eye and that they operate with a similar culture, with a similar mentality, and with similar moral, ethical, and hopefully strategic grounds. I've seen over the years that Microsoft and G42 have been quite similar in their thinking, have been able to scale and adapt. And that is probably evident in Microsoft's foresight in investing in OpenAI and actually deploying the technology. But at the same time, in G42's ability to create technology that is not just UAE dominant, but globally dominant and relevant, whether it's JICE for Climate or JICE in Arabic, or even some of the other use cases that they have through some of their subsidiaries, whether it's Core 42 or M42 or some of the other subsidiaries. In my humble opinion, I think that this is a great marriage of two very innovative companies that will lead to a global impact that is going to spread wide across the UAE and the rest of the world.
And so in your view then, should we rely on the goodwill and the business sense of large AI developers to kind of make secure, responsible decisions? Or are there guidelines and rules that governments like the UAE and US should have in place to ensure that that happens?
So the rules and the guidelines, in my opinion, are not going to be put by specific governments on their own. I think there are global efforts, whether it's the G7 or the G20 efforts on this domain, as well as the UN efforts, which I'm part of, the UN Secretary General's high-level panel on AI governance, as well as the World Economic Forum's efforts on this regard. And if you also look at it, there's also the other global effort, which is the AI Safety Summit that was convened in the UK. Both the UAE and the US have been a part of this. And you'll see as well that both countries are part of most of these conversations. And the conversation that we are part of, the alignment is 100%. 100% in terms of what we think this technology should do and should not do, as well as 100% with regards to how we envision the future of humans with AI and how we envision the future of AI that serves the quality of life improvement and, let's say, the strategic, sovereign advances that both countries are doing. Today, there is, I wouldn't say an arms race. There's a talent race. There's a race for deploying positive AI. And there's a race for regulating against negative AI. And if there are two countries that are extremely aligned in this matter and can definitely usher a movement with other countries as well, it would be the US and the UAE.
I'm not sure that there's 100% alignment on much in the world these days. So hearing that you see that on AI is fascinating to me. I think one of the sticking points or divisions, I guess, I often hear about is the role of China, that it should play in sort of these global conversations around regulation. Certainly in the US and Europe, there's a lot of hesitancy about having China at those tables. Where do you stand when it comes to the role that China should play in shaping these global conversations?
Any party being excluded from a global conversation is negative. And the reason for that is because this technology can go sideways. And this technology can go widespread in a wrong manner in the digital environment that we live in today. So having some sort of alignment or having some sort of guardrail where we're able to actually dictate that this is the vision for AI and humanity, and this is what we expect from you, as whether it's our adversaries or our partners or, you know, our people, is very important. There is another element here. Even if we look at the nuclear arms race that happened during the Cold War, there were conversations that were taking place between the adversaries at the time to actually understand what should or should not be done and how they could maneuver this very delicate environment and this very delicate race. With AI, the problem is this is not just a bomb that you can drop. It's a technology that can proliferate so fast across a digital environment that has no physical borders and that does not have the checks and balances that we have in our physical world. So having a conversation that is inclusive is necessary. I don't think it's a luxury. I think it's a necessity that we need to be pushing for. What was really admirable was the AI Safety Summit in the UK included the big countries like the US and the UK and you know the EU and others as blocks, but it also included China. So I think exclusion is not in anyone's interest, especially for this technology and how it's going to move forward.
Well, with that in mind, you know, the Microsoft deal this week, I can say here in Washington, it's largely being seen as a way for the U.S. to assert its influence over China in the UAE and in the Gulf more broadly. There was a quote from U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo in the New York Times saying, when it comes to emerging technology, you cannot be in both China's camp and our camp. I wonder what you make of that. Should this deal be seen as a reflection of the UAE aligning itself with the U.S. over China?
So there are two ways that we can see this. The first is an issue of sovereignty. No one can assert themselves over anyone, I think, especially if you're going to have a lose-lose situation. Why the U.S. and the UAE came together on this is because there is a win-win-win situation here where the U.S. having access to the talent in the UAE and having access to the models that are being developed is a win. The UAE having access to, as well, what Microsoft is doing and aligning with the U.S. is a win. But also, the collective output of both of these partners or these players coming together is higher than the individual being on its own. In this matter, I think what's going to drive the future of artificial intelligence and the future of these partnerships is economics first and foremost. And that's why you have the Secretary of Commerce, not the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of Homeland Security or someone that's focused on security actually dictating the terms here. But second is today the economic power when it comes to artificial intelligence. And at the same time, you look at the player that is far ahead of the curve, it's the U.S. So you are going to see a lot more of these kind of partnerships. My advice is the U.S. needs to continue to maintain its technological supremacy and the technological edge that it has, because it's important. This is a technology that's unlike any other. We need to move very quickly. And the way that the U.S. is approaching it, especially the Biden administration right now, and Secretary Raimondo more specifically, is very wise. You know, no one can force anyone to the table. But if you're able to curate an agreement or an understanding that will ensure that the sum of the parts is higher and more valuable than the parts on their own, that is what the future is going to be driven on.
You mentioned the U.S. tech supremacy. Certainly, that's a concern here in Washington. It does seem many countries, I would say perhaps including the UAE, see AI as a way to maybe level the playing field or at least bring more tech opportunities and income to other countries. Can you talk a little bit about the role that competition is playing among countries, even as you try to cooperate on some of these rules and regulations around AI?
I don't think it's going to be a zero-sum game where it's only going to be AI that's developed in the US or only going to be AI that's developed in China or the UAE. What is going to happen, I think, is you're going to have centers and nodes of excellence across the world where there are specific use cases or specific domains where a country or a player or a company is doing better than everyone else. We see that even with LLMs, large language models, or generative AI more specifically, OpenAI is dominating in a certain field, but there are, let's say, other players, whether it's American and domestic players like, let's say, Google with Bard, or non-American companies, whether it's Mistral in France or Stable Diffusion at the time in the UK and others. There's going to be, I think, as we continue, there's going to be domains where certain countries are going to try to play in. What makes the agreement between the UAE and the US very interesting to me specifically is the fact that we both bring something to the table that the other party does not have. So if you look at what the UAE brings to the table, the UAE first is the gateway to Africa, the gateway to India and Southeast Asia. And it is, in a way, this perfect hub where the U.S. can actually really showcase its technology for the rest of the developing world in a way that asserts U.S. that is supremacy in this domain. The other thing is, if you look at what the UAE brings to the table, it brings much faster time to market than anywhere else in the world. You can actually deploy your systems here much faster. The regulation is very agile. I'd say the government is very friendly to deployment, especially deployment that is ethical, that impacts the lives of people very positively, and that can be understood. We can change the regulations very, very quickly to make sure that you have this edge of being able to deploy and see the impact. And if, for example, the technology has some ambiguity around it, we have a system called the RegLab, where you're able to containerize the impact in a certain experimental zone and see what it means, and then we change the regulation accordingly, depending on the impacts there. The second thing is you have the world's most diverse population in a cutting-edge environment that is connected, that is, futuristic, and that has talents from all over the world. I think it's very wise, and honestly, it does showcase the U.S.'s ability to really pinpoint a high-quality talent, high-quality environment to invest when it comes to the future and building future technologies as well.
I've seen you make comments before about the UAE being sort of a conduit to many parts of the world, including what we often refer to as the Global South. I'm curious if you can elaborate on some of the diplomatic and commercial benefits of those relationships you're forming, especially as you talk about bringing open source AI models to parts of the world that may not have access to them now.
So let's take a step back. We have the resources, and the U.S. has the resources and the talent and the infrastructure to be able to compete in this domain. If you just reflect on what Fred said with regards to Falcon and being able to export a open source large language model in a way where you're not just saying that we have a large language model, but you're actually saying we have a model that is competing with the big players and is actually on its own right considered a huge success. Many countries cannot afford to do the same thing. So what's going to happen at one point of time, the same way we've seen with regards to the technological revolutions of the past, we are going to see certain companies want to emulate models or systems or actually leverage platforms that are developed elsewhere and do it in a way where they localize it to their use cases. But at the same time, the platform is, whether it's Cisco or Oracle or Salesforce from the US or even something that's more open source like Linux or others, right? What we want to do as the UAE is we want to put out technology that we believe is built well, that showcases what we have in the UAE, but that impacts the lives of people in the Global South in a way where they are part of this revolution they can leapfrog. Think about what mobile broadband did to Africa. They were able to move from conventional financial landscapes to fintech very, very quickly. The same is going to happen with AI. Now, if we're able to build something that is both UAE, US built, it will showcase that there's a trust that the UAE is very similar to us, whether you're in the Middle East or even Africa, they're much closer to us. But it also has the quality certification of the U.S., that this is high quality, that this is cutting edge, that this is innovative. And that's what our diplomatic engine, but at the same time, our reputation and our geographical edge and strategic location brings to the table.
Is the world going to gravitate toward one or two AI models that will sort of dominate, in your view, kind of the way we've seen large internet companies emerge? Or will this market be sort of much more decentralized than that?
It depends on the ability for these large companies to localize. So if you think about, for example, today, the large language models, they're great for general purpose questions. They're great for creative tasks that don't require cultural context, that don't at times also require local dialect or local languages. If the focus was just on us having an English-based large language model that can answer your queries, then it is going to be one or two players. I agree with you on that. If we're going to think about technology that proliferates, where government services can be deployed on them, where we can actually have a friend, an assistant that we can work with regularly to try to overcome challenges and to actually increase our productivity, I think there will be more players. Now, again, what makes us unique as a country is the 200 nationalities that live in the UAE can help you localize your large language model or localize your software to many geographies without having to open offices all around the world. So this is where I think the genius of Microsoft came in. They were able to identify that and say, look, if we want to move very aggressively and we want to make sure that this is the go-to platform and this is the one-stop, let's say, platform that people build on, we have to be able to localize faster than our competition. And maybe that's the advantage that they will have.
The data question around artificial intelligence is, I think, an interesting one because we're sort of running into this dynamic where we're running out of data to train AI models in some instances, especially those in other languages like Arabic. And yet there's also pushback that there's not enough data privacy protections in place, that some of these AI models violate copyright and other intellectual property laws, for instance. How do you navigate that balance between sort of eating all of this data in order to train AI, but not running afoul of some of these privacy or copyright concerns?
So I think there's a twofold answer here. The first part of the answer is we were at one point of time in the wild, wild west. I think as we go forward, it's going to become much more difficult for you to crawl the internet and collect everything that's available there and feed it into your, you know, whether it's transformer models or diffusion models to create something that is a leapfrog in terms of its ability to answer a query or to perform, right? People were so ignorant to the importance of the data and the ability to actually safeguard this data at one point of time that these large companies got away with scraping the internet and crawling it and just feeding it to the machines. Data is going to become more valuable. I think people are starting to actually understand the value of their own data. They're starting to understand the value of what they bring to the table. And that is going to create a sort of symbiosis between me offering my data to a player and training it, but also getting value in the return. Think about social media companies for a second. Every time you use one of these platforms, you understand that it's collecting your data, you understand that it's going to monetize that data, and you understand the risk. But the reason why you keep going back is because there is a certain value that makes you feel like, okay, this is worth giving up. At one point of time, you see government officials and regulators say, you know, where do you draw the line? We need to be a little bit more stricter with regards to the impact of this, whether it's swaying elections or impacting psychological behavior or mental health and so on and so forth. I think this dance will continue. So the government needs to always come and actually see how do we not impact quality of life by, you know, just going straight out and regulating against this technology, but at the same time, ensure that the value, the trade there with me giving my data to this player and what I extract in terms of value is a fair bargain between both players. I don't think a single country can do it on its own. So I don't think the UAE can come and say, you know, these are the restrictions on data and that's the only thing that you can do and that's it, right? Because when you look at what the UAE represents as a percentage of revenue for these big players, it's so minimal that it's easier for them to just switch off the tools that they're building and that will impact the quality of life of people. What needs to happen is the global dialogues that are taking place, whether it's on the UN level, whether it's on the G7 level or the G20 level or so on and so forth, need to be conversations that include that trade-off and also set a bare minimum. If I give you a dollar's worth of data, it's worth a dollar, and this is what you're expected to give me in return. So it needs to be a collective effort, I think.
With artificial intelligence, I guess, how do you prove that value to people? Because to use your social media example, for instance, I do think there are more people now questioning the value of social media, of engaging with these platforms. There are certainly questions about whether these platforms have become so large that engaging with them is simply unavoidable, even though they are taking and using your data. So when it comes to artificial intelligence, how do you kind of prove the case that people are getting value in return for the information they're giving up?
I think that question should be answered by a consortium of economists, of technologists, and of people who are, you know, studying society more broadly. Because I don't think it's as straightforward as me telling you this is how you know, we can actually dictate the price or the value of this. One very important thing is if there is, so there is an element of this which is the return on quality of life, and I'll give you a simple example here. If I tell you today that I'm going to switch off your access to all Google products because Google is extracting more data than it's allowed to, there is a very high likelihood that you're going to say, I'm willing to give them the data because the impact on my quality of life to get me from point A to point B is higher than whatever I'm feeling the negative ramifications to be. The same is true for search, for example. The same is true for YouTube getting access to content and so on and so forth. There is an element here that is really very subjective, depending on the individual and how they feel. So we need to really engage the public in trying to understand where they feel like the pain points are higher, where they feel like the value is higher than what we as government reflect on. My fear always is ignorance drives overregulation. Overregulation at times creates tension and creates maybe a friction between the government and the public. Most governments that have just gone and banned technologies because they didn't understand them or because they felt like the trade-off was too large have backtracked. And I don't think it's healthy for the government to do that, especially if the decision was built on ignorance. So I would love to create a consortium of people with a lot of expertise that can help us determine that value.
I want to turn to some audience questions. The first here, how does the UAE plan to address the energy and environmental implications of scaling up AI infrastructure, especially in terms of energy consumption and carbon footprint?
So that's a fantastic question. This is a global issue that I think is going to be addressed by many countries around the world. We've built energy infrastructure that has always been forecasting for more than what we need. One of the things that the UAE government and the leadership of the UAE has done very wisely is invested in nuclear when countries were shunning nuclear energy. And our nuclear power plants are right now operational and producing an abundance of energy into the grid, which will definitely help us alleviate the use of carbon-emitting, whether it's natural gas or coal or other power plants, to power these systems. The UAE actually has one of the cleanest electric grids in the world. So we have the world's largest solar farm. We have a lot of power plants that are extremely efficient when it comes to energy production, while at the same time reducing pollution. But I think nuclear does really play a big role here in being a game changer. It will be a global crunch when it comes to energy availability to train these systems. The future of AI is going to be, for big part of it, be determined by availability of energy. And I think that's also another thing that makes the UAE special here, is we have a net surplus when it comes to energy production that can be used to train these systems effectively.
Now, you took on your role as the world's first AI minister in 2017. You now have a few colleagues who share that title in other countries, though not many. But things have certainly changed quite a lot in that time in terms of awareness of AI, adoption of AI. Where do you think we're going to be in 5 years from now in terms of both the use of AI and in terms of answering some of these tough regulatory questions?
So first and foremost, it's an inevitability that most countries will need to have, whether it's a minister or a very senior advisor to presidents or prime ministers, like someone quite senior in the government that's looking at AI. Because think about energy, okay? So when electricity became so important for the quality of life, for the economy, and for the security of countries, ministers of energy were actually put in place across every government in the world. AI is going to be the new lifeblood, the new foundation for most governments and for the private sector as well. And we need to have informed, focused government officials that are able to really look at the impact of this technology and are able to steer it, but also at the same time have the international conversations with their counterparts across the world. So this, as you said, this multiplication of different ministers being appointed just shows first that the UAE was ahead of the curve, but also shows that there is a need for this. I don't think we're going to see less ministers of AI. Actually, I think we're going to see more ministers of AI. And my view on this is you want someone who's just focused on the technology. You don't want someone whose focus is so large that they have so many things that they're focusing on and the focus is distributed and not really centralized around AI.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's show comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.